Welcome to the Indestructible Wealth Podcast. This is the place where we help young entrepreneurs and professionals to make, keep, and grow wealth that you can enjoy now and for years to come. I'm your host, Jack Gibson, a serial entrepreneur, founder of multiple seven and eight figure businesses, and wealth building strategist. Each week, I'm going to share my tips, resources, and secrets to help you create a plan and build the life you've dreamed of. Hey guys, welcome back to Indestructible Wealth. Excited to be here. Got a special guest on the line. You know, I talk about in my three pillars, you make it, keep it, grow it, right? So what does that mean? We make more money. We need to increase our earning power. Number two is we need to keep more of what we make through, you know, personal finance decisions, tax reduction, and then grow it, putting it into really great investments that can multiply your money, real estate, a little bit of crypto, right? Stocks, I'm not really a big fan of. I think my own company is my best stock. Yeah. So that is what we're going to talk about today with the real Jason Duncan about, you know, smart entrepreneurship, making more money, and also how to exit without exiting. So we're going to dive in. Jason, thanks so much for being on. First off, my first question, is there a fake Jason Duncan out there? Why the real Jason Duncan right here?
There is a fake Jason Duncan. I own that Instagram account as well, just so okay. Well, the funny story behind all that is that when I got on Instagram, I guess it was 16, 17. I don't remember when I got on Instagram. Somebody said, hey, you need to get on Instagram. So I got on Instagram and Jason Duncan was already taken. And as a lot of first last names already taken, because I was kind of late to the game. And I knew a lot of people were using, you know, add-ons, either official or the real, like everybody with these things to their name so they could have their name and their Instagram handle. I just picked the real. And so that was it. I didn't give it any thought other than that. And then fast forward about 2 or 3 years, and now I'm actually coaching, speaking, things are going on, and I don't have a personal brand to speak of. And a personal branding coach came to me and she said, this is her true story. She reached out through LinkedIn. She wanted to offer me a free 30-minute personal branding consult. I'm like, okay. So I scheduled it for like a Saturday morning so I could sit out on the front porch, drink coffee, and talk to this lady. Yeah. And she did all her homework. She was awesome. She got on the call. She started talking about all my personal branding. And she goes, my opinion is that you just need to be the real Jason Duncan. And I said, what do you mean? She explained, like, that your Instagram handle, this is what you can kind of claim that as your brand and just make it yours. And I said, okay. So I went and bought therealjasonduncan.com, and that's what it turned into. That lady never followed up with me. I don't remember her name. I didn't pay her a dime for the advice. And that's how I became the real Jason Duncan.
So she could have maybe sold you like a coaching package or something, right?
Yeah, for sure. I've been talking about her ever since because everybody asked that question. Right. And I'll tell you one other quick thing, Jack, about this. And this is kind of funny. But so jasonduncan.com used to be owned by a guy, obviously, Jason Duncan. He was a musician in Texas somewhere. And when I first found that domain back, golly, 10 years ago, he had it pointed to a MySpace page. I'm not even kidding.
Oh wow.
It was pointed to a MySpace page and it didn't even have anything on the MySpace page. So I found the guy, reached out to him, said, hey, I want to buy the domain. This is before the real Jason Duncan existed, even in Instagram. This is way back. And he wouldn't sell it. I offered him $500, offered him $1,000. He wouldn't sell it. Well, then I had that conversation with that lady. I became the real Jason Duncan. So really jasonduncan.com to me didn't make any, I didn't need it anymore. Well, about 3 years ago, a Google broker, domain broker reached out to me and said, hey, we'd like to offer you to buy jasonduncan.com. I said, I don't really need it, but yeah, I'd like to have it. And I said, how much? $50,000 is what they wanted to sell it.
They're like holding you hostage or something with your name.
I told him, you're crazy. Why? You're crazy. Well, some famous person will want to buy it. And I said, hold on a minute. You realize I'm the most famous Jason Duncan on the planet and nobody knows who I am. Like, I'm your best shot. I'll give you $1,000. And they said no. So I was like, okay, I don't even need it.
F off. What? So they're still at 50? Like, how long ago was that?
It was 2 or 3 years ago. I mean, the broker.
You went back to him. No, you just don't care that much, right?
I don't need it. It doesn't matter to me.
You just wanted to maybe control it and obsolete it or something. So nobody else has it.
I wouldn't have it pointed to my website, but I haven't looked in ages. I don't know if somebody else bought it, but We'll see.
Yeah, man. Some people just, they need to get like really more grounded on what things are actually worth. I mean, it's
crazy.
We're not like in the COVID money printing days right now, right?
That's
we're,
right.
It's different. All right, Jason. So a little background on you. What, you started off as a broke school teacher. You know, you're a mega entrepreneur. What you said when I asked you that, you said, is there any other kind of teacher? Yeah, I'm with you. My wife was a teacher when we first got married for the first 5 years. And the only good thing about it was our first baby cost $5. You know? That was the only good thing about it financially.
The copay.
Yeah, the $5 copay. And then our second son, you know, she had retired and was a stay-at-home mom, and it was $5,000 for the second one. So it was a little bit of like, hey, I miss these benefits. So you miss anything about teaching? And, you know, what, tell me the backstory here.
Well, Jack, I love teaching, man. It's why I'm on the planet. I'm a teacher. God gave me that gift. I love doing it. You know, I only taught for 4 years because I was a pastor for 13 years before that, my first career out of high school and college, and then went into teaching after I got a master's in education, and truly loved the craft of teaching. I love the performance of teaching. I love the impact of teaching. I loved interacting with the kids. I taught eighth graders, and I loved it. It was fantastic. I would still be in it today, except for the Great Recession, coming through that, their school systems were just laying teachers off because they didn't have the budgets, and, sure, you know, revenues were down for tax collection. You know, I really do miss it. I miss being in the classroom. Now, would I go back today? Perhaps, but not right now. Like, I'm still building all these, I own 7 other companies. I'm still building. I'm not in a position where I can take my foot completely off the gas and watch everything continue to rise.
Sure.
But if at some point, you know, I'm sitting on $100 million in cash somewhere and I don't need to do anything at all to keep any of that going, you know, maybe I could go back into the classroom because I do enjoy it, but they don't pay. It doesn't pay. Like, so now I exercise the teaching gift and the impact that I'm making with my coaching clients and speaking on stages and writing books and my mastermind. So I'm getting to exercise that just in a different format.
Yeah. Now you can actually get paid what you're worth.
Yes. Yeah. Yes. I charge a lot more.
I bet the market is dictating what you get paid versus the government in the school teaching system dictating what you get paid. So you were a pastor for 13 years. That's amazing. And I actually have been building churches out or helping to fund them get going. So that's pretty amazing ability as an entrepreneur, right? You get to make money, more money, and then you get to donate it to things that you're really passionate about. So you were making money, I'm sure, as a pastor. Then you go into school teaching, not making much money there. So you had all these years of really not making much money. How did you able to change your money mindset to be able to then transition into where and accepting, you know, abundance? I'm sure that wasn't an easy process or conversion.
That is a great question. Yeah. And I don't think it's one that enough people talk about because I'm not unique, right? Maybe my story is pastor than a teacher than an entrepreneur, but I think my story, my money story, really is not a unique thing. I think that most humans, Western, you know, in the Western world, they grow up with a bad money story. That money, money is, that we don't think about it in terms of what it actually is as a tool that, if put in the hands of a master craftsman, can make amazing things happen and we can impact the world. We look at it as just a means by which we get things that we want. And we have to work, we have to trade our time on earth for it. And that's not at all what money is. And so I grew up with a bad money story. I grew up with a money story that said that rich people were probably crooks. Rich people probably, you know, if you're driving an expensive car, Ferrari, a Lamborghini, or a really high-end other luxury car, you know, I didn't trust you. I didn't like you. And nobody said any of that to me. I wasn't sat down and told these things. It was just that money story that got woven into my childhood through my environment.
Yeah. And we get that from society, right? I mean, you look at the top 10 movies of all time, they all have an evil rich villain in them.
Yep.
And so that subconsciously creates this lack of trust for people that are rich. We want to be rich when we're not, but then we also hate people that are rich subconsciously because of the programming. So yeah, I think a lot of it is the programming, and it can come from a lot of different places beyond, you know, movies and media.
Yeah. I've always had a really expensive tastes I have high standards for things. I've always liked, I like expensive things. Obviously in ministry and as a teacher, I couldn't afford them, but I did the best with what I had. But my, I remember my wife for years always wanted a BMW 7 Series. Yeah. And of course I'm a pastor. I'm like, listen, even if we could afford it, I can't drive it because it looks bad. Again, it goes back to that bad money story.
Sure.
Well, then we got to the place where I could afford one. She doesn't want one. So how's that work? But to your question, Jack, I think that I went from school teacher or for pastor to school teacher to millionaire as an entrepreneur, but didn't realize how much my life had changed. I didn't realize how much that money had changed my life in mostly good ways. I mean, I don't even think there's any negative ways that it changed me, but I didn't realize the wealth that I had access to until I probably had been an entrepreneur for 7 years. And we were doing millions of dollars in revenue and $1 million plus bottom line. And when I became aware of that, it's like, whoa, this is new. This is different. I have access to different people, access to different networks. And now the impact that I've always wanted to make on the world, I can make one because I have access to capital and resources where before I only had just my will and my desire to do it. Now I have the tools that I can do it with.
That's fantastic. I love the analogy of the master craftsman, right? Being a good steward with, you know, what God has entrusted you with, and then using that to change the world for a better place. It's a really great outlook on money. I think you're right. I mean, most people look at it from a perspective of what am I getting out of this, getting this money, right? What can I buy? And my thought process is, yeah, I want those nice things. I want the Tesla. I want the dream home. I want the nice vacations with the fam, but how can I then utilize this money to make a far bigger impact and reach more people with a message of living a better life?
Yeah.
So it sounds like what you're up to. You're teaching people how to live a better life.
Yeah. And really that is the bottom line here. It's, you know, my life's mission is to use my gifts of teaching and my gifts of leadership to help other people achieve success in their life and find the purpose that God has put them on this planet for. That's what I want to do.
That's awesome. One more question on the money mindset. When you were transitioning from school teacher, broke school teacher, to millionaire entrepreneur, did you have any self-sabotage financially going on? I know that happens with a lot of people where you start to make a lot of money and then it's almost like subconsciously you're resisting that because you've been programmed to earn at a certain level, not much for so long. Did you do anything, you know, where you kind of just got rid of the money somehow, that self-sabotage situation?
Actually, no, I don't. I can't think of one. Maybe a psychologist could help diagnose that, but no, I don't. I mean, we got out of debt, personal debt, as quickly as we were able, you know, truck payments and credit cards and school loans. And we didn't have the education for investing, but I had the awareness that I should know about it. And that was what was causing so much trouble. Is I didn't know how money worked. And I'm only recently, within the last four or five years, learned how it truly works. And I know I've still got a long way to go, but I just knew that I didn't know stuff. So I had conscious incompetence of how to handle money. And today I know some people are better at it. You're probably much better at it than me. Most people who earn a lot of money, they don't earn a lot of money and it keeps growing on their earnings. Now the money may grow, the assets may grow, but the earnings are highs and lows. And I've experienced that significantly. You know, I'd have huge years and then the next year would be low and then the next year high. And that sucks. Because as a school teacher and as a pastor, I never had those peaks and valleys. It was 45 grand a year, you know, for all the way through teaching, you know, I think last year I taught was 38 grand a year, but you know, it was steady and I knew what to expect and it was predictable. As an entrepreneur, not so much. And so I didn't really know how to handle it, but I don't think I self-sabotaged.
Okay. Okay, that's good. So you have these up and down swings. I mean, isn't that almost like every entrepreneur goes through that, especially in the beginning, right? The first 5 years, maybe first 10 years, you know, you're going to have a lot of volatility. That's common with any startup, right? Like it's going to have volatility. So what do you see? You coach a lot of entrepreneurs. What do you see them making the mistake of that? As soon as the income goes up, like they're spending to that level, or like what are the mistakes that you see with the guys you're coaching?
Some of the guys spend up to it Some don't. And I think most don't, at least in my experience. I think what they do is they don't know what to do with it and make the mistake of, quote, reinvesting it back into the business, but they're actually making pretty poor choices on what that might look like. And their reinvestments don't free their time up. And the time is the most important asset that they have. So rather than leveraging all this extra money for more time in their life, quality of life, a better life, as you talked about a minute ago, they end up investing it into the business in multitude of different ways without really affecting the business by making it a larger asset and by giving them more time. Now, introducing the real Jason Duncan and what I teach, right? So what I teach is, hey, leverage money to get time. Money is renewable. You can get more of that. Time is not. Yeah. Don't leverage your time to get money. Leverage your money to get time.
That's good. So what does that look like in terms of what are the mistakes that people are making when they're reinvesting back into their business? Because I personally think if you're growing a business, your number one investment besides your mindset and your personal development is putting that money to good use, smart decisions back into your own business to scale it. Versus you have the other option, right? If you can take your money and you can put it into other people's companies, AKA stocks, private, you know, equities, such. I think you're going to make the biggest impact in how I got very wealthy was just constantly just putting it back in. But I also understand that you can throw money back in to your business and then like it's a total waste and didn't do anything. So what do you see there?
Yeah, I think people make bad decisions on hiring more staff because you can afford it. And so they just think more people it'll work. And they don't consider individual employees and team members as investments. And this is the conundrum. This is the paradox. Hey, I just made an extra $500,000 this year that I don't need personally. Let me reinvest it into the business. And they say, okay, $500,000, I could hire five people at $100,000 each, just to make math easy. I could hire five people at $100,000 and give me that 1 year runway to get them going. But then they say that they're going to do that as an investment, but then they treat them as an expense. And there's a huge difference. So if you bring these five people in and you said, I'm investing that, but then you treat them as an expense because they show up on the P&L. They don't show up on the balance sheet. They show up on the P&L as an expense, a line item expense. And then you consider all of that as expense and not an investment and you stop tracking it. So in reality, if you spend $100,000 or whatever the number is on an employee, that employee, in my opinion, should net you $300,000 in benefit to the bottom line of the company. And if they can't, then that probably is somebody that's not an employee that you need. You can probably get that handled through some other technology or some system to get the same output without spending all the money. So I think it's a 3-to-1 dollar ratio on an employee, their benefit back to the company. So a lot of people like make the mistake that they invest, you know, whatever that means, in these extra employees because they have all this extra money, but the employee is not bringing in a bottom line equivalent to even equal to what you're paying them.
Have you kind of dove into artificial intelligence as a way to invest and utilize that to free up time and to maybe not have to hire so many people? Like I was just studying a course right now and it gave seven different artificial intelligence, you know, sites or tools that can help you to be more effective with your time and replicating yourself so that you can get more done. You can focus on the other parts of your business.
Yes, I'm a huge fan of AI, and I understand that we're at this spot in the world history where it's just as big as when the internet came out in the mid-90s. Yeah. I mean, ChatGPT is going to change the world in as many or more ways that the World Wide Web did in 94, 95. Yeah, wow. I think it's that big of a deal. So now, have I learned how to leverage that correctly? Not yet.
Yeah.
I do know that creative writing and copywriters, like, guys, you need to figure other things out. You need to figure another job out because AI is going to take your jobs. But prompts, you know, being able to understand how to prompt the AI to do the right thing. But back to the original question, is I do believe that the way we can invest that extra money as entrepreneurs when we have those ups is in technology and systems and assets. Because what you have to do is you got to create your business where it is an asset that has value that is not directly tied to you as the owner. that makes your business more valuable. So if whatever you invest back into the business, invest it in such a way that if an outside investor walks in and says, I want to look at the value of your business, they see lots of asset value, and it's not tied to your ability to run daily operations.
Right. Because the way I've understood it when I've looked into acquiring businesses, and I think that that's and I agree with you, artificial intelligence, we're on the cusp of probably maybe even bigger than the World Wide Web when you look at, you know, just an incredible amount of applications, but we'll see, right? We don't know. It's still so early. What is it that you, and can you give me any examples of, it seems to me that you're in favor of looking at, if I had to hire somebody, a person, or if I can hire, or I can not hire, if I can deploy the money and the cash that I have into something that can make me more productive, to make me more efficient. Is that your kind of your concept of the technology, and that's, we want to use the tech exclusively for just making ourselves better at what we do, more efficient, free up time?
Yeah. I think the idea, you know, I teach a concept called exit without exiting, which is the title of my book that came out earlier this month. And the idea behind that is that the first thing you have to understand is you've got to embrace delegation. So you cannot be the guy running around doing everything. The business cannot revolve around your personality or your ability or your skill or your network. It has to grow beyond that. It's like a kid. You can't carry your baby every day for the rest of its life. You can't feed it every day. There are months and a couple of years, actually, that you're really carrying that kid and protecting that kid and feeding the kid and teaching the kid how to walk and run. But at some point, the kid's got to do all that on his own. You know, anybody with a 10-year-old kid that you're still carrying around on your hip and spoon feeding, that kid's got development problems. And so most entrepreneurs treat their businesses the same way. And one way to get out of that is by delegating, understanding truly what that is. And delegation is not just to humans, although I think that's the first place you look, is who on my team can do some of this stuff that I don't need to be doing, other people can do. And then the second thing is elimination of stress. One of the core concepts I teach is about stress elimination. It's like, as entrepreneurs, you cannot run around like a chicken with your head cut off, because the company will never rise above you ever anyway. And so if you're running around stressed out all the time, your company's going to feel stress, and that stress vibrates on a certain frequency, and your customers and vendors in the community feels that, and they don't want to do business with people like that. So I think those are two big things. And then the third and fourth principles I teach are our establishment of systems and processes, which is really what we were talking about there, using AI to do that. And then the fourth is investing in people, which goes back to the original question. Invest properly in humans. Don't just hire humans. Invest in them. Show them that they have the power, the authority, and the rank to act on your behalf, that you've given them authority to do things. And you're showing them, hey, I'm giving you this salary, and my expectation as an investor is that there's going to be a return on this. And if there is, that's fantastic. It's what we want. If there's not, then you're not necessary. And of course, you don't, it's not as blunt as that, but that's the idea.
Got it. So your book, you just wrote the book. It just came out. Tell me a little bit about the book, Exit Without Exiting.
Yeah. So here's what it looks like. Exit Without Exiting just came out March 3rd on my birthday.
Congratulations, man.
Thank you.
I know it's a huge ordeal to write a book. I've gone through the process, and it takes a long time.
Yeah. It took almost a year longer than I thought it would take to get that book out. But the book is now an international bestseller in several categories. It's all about how to exit your business without selling it and begin living what I call the exit lifestyle, which is having the choices to make every day and the control over those choices to do what you want, whether it's to go to the office and work, whether it's to build a new development center in your business or add a new line or start a new division or start a whole nother business. Like, those are the options that you should have as an entrepreneur. And this book is designed to show you how to get those options.
So let's dive into the process here so you can give the audience a taste of what you do. What does that process, like the steps, you want to dive into those deeper on what you cover in the book and your platform?
Yeah. So I briefly went through that just a minute ago in that other answer, but there's four core principles: embrace delegation, elimination of stress, establishment of systems and processes, and then fourth, investing in people. Those are the four core principles. And around that, you will be able to exit without selling. Or if you want to sell, you can also sell, because a business with the owner operator is worth 30 to 50% less than a business where the owner is not the operator. So if you can get yourself out of the business, if you're planning on selling it, you get yourself out first, then sell it, because it'll be worth a lot more money.
Yeah.
But all of that doesn't matter if your mindset isn't right. Like if you have the mindset that entrepreneurship and business ownership is all about having a better job than you had before, that'll never work. You can do all of those things I told you, and it's not going to work, because your mindset is blocking you from getting to where you want to go. So your mindset is critical in developing a successful life. So if you're working 50, 60 hours a week, you're on the verge of burnout, you like your business, but it's not really providing the lifestyle that you want, I can show you how to get out of that. And it starts with mindset shift, and then you start implementing those principles.
Yeah, I know what I was going to say that I forgot to finish, is that when you're looking at buying a business, which I think is a huge opportunity, aging baby boomers they need some place to offload their businesses, right?
Yeah.
When you look at what are they sold for, the more that the operator, the owner is the operator, I mean, the less that they're worth. I mean, it's like, because you're buying a job. If you have to come in and you have to take over all of the operations that they were running themselves, then or then if you have to hire a employee to do all that, which is going to drastically reduce your profitability in a lot of cases, then yeah, your multiple is so much less. So your strategy is, okay, let's create a business where we can take you as the owner out of the operations. You can be more of the, I don't know, what would you call it? Overseer, a strategic type of
owner investor is what I look at. You go from owner operator to owner investor.
Owner investor. And what's the difference in those types of multiples of sales? Like if I'm buying a business that has, you know, the owner is the operator and they're full time and they're grinding and they're working the 50, 60 hours, right? Versus what you're saying, where you're kind of exited without exiting as the owner, still retain ownership, but not involved in the day to day. That's
well, it can double.
I was gonna say triple, quadruple even.
Well, and here's the thing. So if you talk to business brokers, and I've had business brokers on my podcast and on my webinar series, and we talk about this because I'm very interested in how this works out in the real life, in the real world. But
yep.
If you talk to them, they'll say a business with an owner operator is worth in valuation 30 to 50% less off the top. Boom. That's it. But that doesn't tell the whole story. The whole story actually is involved a little deeper. Because 75% of businesses that are listed for sale never sell. Now think about that. 75% of businesses that list for sale never sell. Now, some businesses never list for sale. They just close because they don't know what to do. They don't know how to exit. They don't have a strategy. They just work until they can't anymore and the business closes. But if you took the initiative and you went to sell it, 3 out of 4 times, that business is not going to sell. Why? It's because the owner is the operator. And so here's the thing. The multiple can be double if you get an offer. But most buying decisions from people like you and me who go acquire businesses, we're going to look at a business and say, okay, the owner is the operator. I'm not interested. It's not, I'm going to offer you half. It's, I'm not interested. I'm walking away now. Mm-hmm. So to your point, Jack, does the multiple just go double or does it go triple? It's an infinite difference in a business valuation between the owner operator and an owner who is not the operator, who is, as I call, the owner investor. You're kind of sitting back as the vision caster. You're the one building the asset. You're communicating a vision. You're the architect of the business, but you're not involved in the daily operations.
So how do we get out of operations and become that owner investor? I got the 4 steps. So what else can you tell me? Because that's a critical part of entrepreneurship.
Well, the delegation part, I think, is one of the biggest things I talk about. It was actually the subject of my TED talk last year. My first TED talk that I did was about how to escape the ironic prison of entrepreneurship, and delegation was the key. So I teach a very specific method on delegation because a lot of people think that they know what it is and how to do it and think that they're good at it. But in reality, most entrepreneurs practice either confiscation or abdication. They don't practice delegation. And the difference is, even though they rhyme, abdication, which was my sin as an entrepreneur, abdication is a word we don't hear much, but it's when Like, for instance, when a king gives up the right to his throne and just gives it up, that's called an abdication of the throne. So we as entrepreneurs sometimes assign a task to someone, and it's still our responsibility to make sure it gets done, but we're assigning it to someone, and then we never go back and look and see if it got done. That's called abdication. We think that we delegated it, but we didn't. We abdicated it. And that was my problem. I trust people really too much, probably. And I'd give a task and I'd never go back and look. And, you know, they screwed it up and we lose revenue, we lose profit. And that's my fault. And the other entrepreneurs practice confiscation. And confiscation is when I delegate a task, but then I look over the person's shoulder all the time, like, hey, don't do it that way. Do it this way. Don't do it. Well, you'd be better if you did it. You know what? Just give it to me. And we take it back. And so this delegation thing is not as cut and dry as most people think that it is. There is actually a method by which you can delegate, become a master delegator. And I teach that method to my clients. I talk about it in the book. It's a very specific method. If you do this, you actually free your time up.
Can you dive into that specific method is?
Yeah. So I teach what I call the training wheels of delegation. There's six steps that are this training wheels. And if you think about it, like back when you learned to ride a bike, we all did it. You know, our dad put on these little training wheels on the back wheel and we could, you know, teeter a little bit, but we had control of the bike ourselves and we didn't know how to balance it. And then eventually you take those training wheels off.
Sure.
And then your dad's holding the back of the seat and as kind of like just keeping you balanced until you can ride it on your own. So this method I teach is the training wheels. It's not a permanent, like this is not what you do forever. This is how you learn to delegate. And the six steps are this. Number one, you're going to make a top 10 list of the things that you're doing on a regular basis that somebody else could be doing. So you just write out that list like, well, I'm checking my own email. I'm scheduling my own appointments. I'm doing my own bookkeeping. I'm writing my own checks, whatever it happens to be. What are some 10 things that you're doing that really somebody else could be doing? Those are minimum wage activities that you shouldn't be doing. All right. That's step one. Step two, you're going to pick one item from that list and you're going to delegate that to somebody for 30 days. Now, there's a whole methodology about what delegation actually looks like, how to do it. And I don't have time to get into it now, but you have to actually delegate the right way, which is there's certain questions that have to be answered, but that's for another discussion. So write the top 10 list, delegate to somebody for 30 days. That's it. That is just one task, 30 days is training wheels. The third is you're going to check in with that person once a week, no more and no less. And so if you're doing math, that's only four check-ins over 30 days. So you say, hey, Bob, I need you to do this task, whatever it is, for 30 days. I'm going to check in. We're going to check in on Thursday mornings at 9:00. You're just going to if you got questions between that 10 times, you just come ask. But otherwise, I'm not going to go confiscate it back and I'm not going to abdicate it. I'm going to delegate it, which means we're going to check in once a week.
Why just once a week? Is that keep you more from doing too much?
If you do it more, you're gonna confiscate because you're not gonna like what he did. If you do it less than that, you're gonna abdicate. So check this once a week is really, really good for an owner to learn to trust his employees, but to guide them through the process. Now, step four is the hardest step. This is one where everybody goes off the rails. Step four is
there's always a spot where they go off the rails.
Yes. Step four is the one. So step four is if you're learning to become a master delegator at these check-in meetings, you cannot correct your employee. You can only praise them. You cannot correct them. You can only praise them. Why? Okay. There's several reasons why. So Bob walks in at his check-in meeting and he says, all right, boss, here's what I did last week. And you know, intuitively that is not correct. You did not, it wasn't right. There's so many better ways he could have done that. You don't correct him. Why? Well, if you correct him, you are holding the back of the seat forever. You got to let go of the seat. He's not going to learn how to ride the bike on his own. He's got to fail. We learn more by what we fail through than what we're taught to do. So you've got to let them fail. He's got to screw it up. Now, caveat, if somebody's going to go to jail, somebody's going to die, the building's going to blow up because of something he's doing wrong, obviously step in and correct it, fix the situation. But the reality is that's not going to happen.
Yeah.
He's not going to design
gonna take the your thing. Company under and with his decision making, you might want to.
Yeah. So that check in. Yeah. That check in only praising, not correcting. So if he comes in and he really did a bad job, you just say something like, well, hey, I like your tie today. It looks nice. I mean, you got to figure something out. And remember, this is 30 days. It's not permanent. You're going to survive the dip. The things that he does wrong, you'll survive. Fifth step is called the 80% rule. And the 80% rule is you're only looking for Bob or whomever it is to do it at 80% of the desired output. Most entrepreneurs are wanting 100%. And frankly, you're just not going to get it. Not early anyway. I had an employee I hired right out of college almost 10 years ago at one of my companies. And at the time, he didn't know jack about what I'm doing. He had no idea. And he screwed up a lot.
Yep.
But eventually, I let him fail enough, and he got to 80%, and I backed off completely. I'm like, Ricky, this is all yours, man. This is on you. You've got it from here. Check, let me know if you had any questions. And he was 80% for a couple of years. I mean, that's a long time to not do it at 100% of my expectation. He was at 80%. Well, today, he can run circles around me. Like, he's much better at all that stuff than I ever was. And that's the investment. See, I made an investment. I lost I had to let go of something, and then it came back to me in spades. So that's step five. And then the sixth step is repeat that process every 30 days until your list is empty. And that's how you move from owner operator to owner investor.
That's going to make a huge difference in your productivity and your bottom line and in training and retaining. I love it. So this is what you teach to your entrepreneurs coaching clients?
That's right. Yeah. The delegation is a big, big thing. As a matter of fact, it's part of all the courses. I've got coaching courses that I teach and group coaching programs. I've got online courses, and it's part of it because it's such a significant part of it. But I actually just over the last week or so, I've been thinking about creating just a master delegator course, just standalone. And all we do is talk about delegation. I don't know if that'll come to fruition or not, but I'm toying with the idea.
You know, one thing I forgot to ask you, how did you make your first million? Like what business were you in when you,
so I started,
transitioned from a school teacher to entrepreneur?
Yeah. So I started a lighting company, LED lighting. And we did lighting retrofits in commercial buildings all around the country, mostly in hospitals and warehouses, distribution centers. And I didn't know anything about the lighting business. All I knew how to sell. And I had a sense that LED lighting back in 2010, 2011, when I started the company, I had a sense that that was kind of the next big wave of technology and energy efficiency. And as it turns out, I was exactly right. And it made me a millionaire.
Then what? Where'd you go from there? Is that when you started teaching other entrepreneurs, or was there something in between?
So I started that business in 2010. I still own that business today. I did the exit without exiting method. Right. That's how I learned how to do it. Yeah. So I dedicate the book to my team at ELS because they allowed themselves to be the guinea pigs of this whole experiment. Cause I didn't know if it was going to work or not. I didn't know if me completely being away from the business was going to work. And it has worked. I started out checking in with them, 10 hours a week. I'd come into the business maybe one day, maybe half a day, another day a week. And then it was 10 hours a month and then 10 hours a quarter. And frankly, right now I maybe 10 hours a year I put into that business. They send me documents I have to sign every once in a while. I go to a meeting like this Friday, we're having a big team meeting, and I'll go to that as a participant. I'm not there to lead it. But I put in very little time in that business. Since I stepped away from the daily operations, I went on to start six other companies. I'm in the process of trying to acquire one right now. But the coaching business, what I'm doing now, started officially after I stepped away from the daily operations. But that wasn't what I was heading to. I didn't get out of daily operations to go start a coaching business. I actually didn't know what the hell I was going to do. I had no idea what I was going to do next. And I went through about 4 months of this a big identity crisis. And then eventually it came back around as I hired coaches to help me. Like, Jason, you're a teacher. Figure out how to use that gift to help people know what you did. And so people wanted to know, how do I exit without exiting? How do I become a less burnout entrepreneur who really enjoys life and business again? And that's what I do now.
I love passive income. I talk about it all the time on my podcast and my book. And I found that the best passive income that you can create is from building a business and then letting that business run, right, without your day-to-day involvement. I've bought a lot of real estate. Real estate's I call a lot of real estate, especially rental property, it's a semi-passive business, right? Because you still have profits coming in and you still have expenses. You still have, even if you have a management company, you still have to manage the management company. So I think you can create far more passive income
with what you're saying, exit without exiting, than anything else. Is that what you found too with your own, you know, putting your money to work? And what's your greatest source of passive income?
Well, yeah, it's the businesses.
It's the businesses, right? Yeah, exactly.
It's the businesses. Now we're in real estate. I have a real estate investing company that I started as well. And we own short-term rentals and we want to grow that portfolio, but it does require work. It's not much, but it does require work. And there are some time resources you have to dedicate to that. But well, my business,
if you don't have a team and you're doing that, that could be a full-time job.
And my wife, you know, she does a really great job of running our short-term rental stuff right now. And I want to buy three more this year, if possible. It's kind of a down market right now. Short-term rentals hit their heyday during COVID, but now with interest rates as high as they are, it's tough. But I would still like to get three more apartment complexes. Is something I've always been interested in, but I just haven't found the one that I want to pull the trigger on. Commercial buildings, you know, I think just owning commercial buildings. So from real estate, I still like the idea, but I'm a business guy, right? I love business. I love training people. I don't want to start another business. I'll tell you that.
I'm done.
No more startups for me, man. But I tell you, the idea of acquiring a business is, you know, you and I do that. I'm looking at acquiring one now, and I think there's a great opportunity here. I don't think the business that I'm looking at has been maximized. I think they're succeeding, but anybody buying a business always thinks they can do it better. Well, I think I could do it better. And I think that it wouldn't require a ton of time to make it better. Maybe 6 months if I'm really pushing hard, and then boom, you know, then I can step back again and not have to run it.
So what do you think is the major key to your successes with your coaching business? Are you pushing out a lot of content? I mean, you've got a book, you've got a podcast, you've got social channels. Like, do you feel like the digital marketing, that pushing out content, is the biggest thing, that you most important thing you can do in that to grow it? What's working for you?
Yeah, for the coaching business, it's the hardest business I've ever started. I started a lot of companies. That's, I think I found
that, it's so 12. Funny. It's funny you say that. Yeah. I found the same thing with Indestructible Wealth. Yeah.
It's so tough, Jack, because you know, you can get some people to pay you a little money for your expertise.
Yeah.
You can get a few people to pay you a lot of money for your expertise, but to get a lot of people to pay you any money for your expertise is hard.
Yeah.
And that's what I'm struggling with. And I've been doing this. You know, I officially kicked off my coaching. I'd been coaching 4 or 5 years prior to my exiting, but I was doing it for fun. I just enjoyed helping people. People I knew come to me and ask me for help. And I was doing that kind of in the afternoons and evenings after I got off, left the office. You know, people would come by and I'd work with them. But I officially launched the coaching company in 2020. And it has been the hardest slog to have to create profit. Like, I've got pretty good top line revenue, but I pour everything back into the business to, you know, whether it's marketing plans, and I just haven't figured out that thing. It's tough. But your question was, what's the secret? Well, the secret is consistency. You just got to be consistent. You got to stay in front of the camera. You got to stay in front of people. You got to get attention. I think Grant Cardone talks about that, is that attention is the currency. You got to get people's attention. So that's why I love being on shows like yours. I love going on podcasts. I love speaking on stages. I mean, I'll speak pretty much anywhere for free as long as the audience is quality. I don't need to get paid to be there, because I'm looking to get attention. I want to be in front of people. And the reason I want to be in front of people is not because I'm trying to build an ego. I'm trying to build a lifestyle for people that they truly enjoy. Because I don't think business ownership, I don't think people get the right, they don't have the right mindset, like we talked about. They think business ownership is just to have a better job. And I'm going to teach you a better way. I think you can live the exit lifestyle while still owning the business, without a VC firm, without a private equity coming and buying you up, because that ain't going to happen. 2% of businesses ever make enough money at the sale that the guy who sold it is financially independent. So I want to help you live the real life of what it looks like to could have sold it, but you didn't. You still own it, and you get to live the exit lifestyle anyway. That's what I want to help people do.
That's awesome. Yeah, I've found myself personally, and I'm like, man, I'm tracking everything you're saying about how hard it is. I think it's that there's so much noise that you have to compete with. I mean, if you think about, like, there's 20, I don't know, I'm probably making this up, but it was 20 million short form videos go out, get pushed out per day, right? And so you're trying to compete for people's attention, particularly you have to have their attention or on your content, or it doesn't really matter whether you push it out or don't push it out if you have no attention on it. So you're just competing with so much noise and trying to break through that. It's I found it to be, you know, extremely difficult because, well, you're competing with what, Netflix, Amazon Prime, you're competing with porn channels, OnlyFans, you're competing with, right, all the people that are established in your niche that are already pushing out tons of content. What have you, what's worked for you to break through that? I mean, you've done, obviously you've done really well if you're getting, talking about the top line revenue being so strong.
Well, I think going back to the, it's consistency of pushing out good content. I talk about it this way.
I guess, particular platform or particular anything particular that's worked for you the best.
So specifically Instagram and short form videos have been the biggest thing on Reels. And then I also duplicate that into YouTube Shorts and on LinkedIn as well. I played the TikTok game, but man, that company's shady. I don't trust them. So I got off the TikTok game. I'm not there at all, but Instagram Reels and doing the short form videos a minute or so, that's been probably the biggest thing. I've picked up hundreds of thousands of dollars worth of clients and revenue because somebody saw me on a podcast that I cut up, my team cut up for me and popped out, you know, just a quick answer to a question. Or, you know, I did a video, like a formatted video scripted, and I talked to the camera. That to me is getting me more attention and access to clients than just about anything else. The other thing I would say is that speaking on stages for me, because I'm a really good public speaker. I've got lots of reps. I was a pastor for a long time, was a school teacher. Like that. I know how to talk in front of people. So when I get in front of people, you know, I can, if it's the right audience, I can bring in a couple hundred thousand dollars in revenue just by being on stage and having the right people in the audience. And they come to me and they're like, dude, I got to work with you because I need what you're talking about. And I'll sign up clients into my mastermind or my, you know, coaching programs or something like that.
Funny about the short form video. I've found it easier. I have a syndicated fund that I raise capital for. We invest into car washes and self-storage facilities, and the returns are 25% to 35% annualized. I mean, it's amazing. And I found it easier to get somebody to invest $100,000 into that versus getting a short form video to go anywhere. I mean, for all those listening out there where your short form video really aren't going anywhere, look, I feel you and I understand, you know, it is difficult, but I think that's a skill that just has to be figured out in today's age because at least 50% from what I've read of all internet traffic is short form video up to, I've read 90%. I don't think it's that high, but somewhere in that range, we know it's a lot, right?
Yeah.
So how do you get good at short form video? Probably one of our last questions. How have you gotten good? Because I think this is a critical, critical part of being a modern day entrepreneur, digital marketing with short form video.
You know, 40 years ago, if you didn't have an ad in the yellow pages, you weren't in business, you know, and 20 years ago, if you didn't have a website, you know, cause the web was coming out brand new. If you didn't have a website, you weren't in business. Yeah. And today I think it's, if you're not doing short form video content on a regular, consistent basis, people don't know who you are. Now there are exceptions to every rule. There were people who weren't in the yellow pages and people who don't have websites who still succeeded, but those are the anomalies, they're not the rule. But today I think it's consistency. So I record a short form video every single day. Now I don't post one every day, but I record one every single day. I have a calendar. My intern, Justin, who's on the other side of the camera right now, helping me with this today. You know, he helps write some scripts. I record those. I put them in my folder and then I've got a VA who edits them and I've got a team that pushes them out. I think the consistency and the reps, just like anything else, I started doing short form videos. Well, they weren't really short form, but I started doing videos daily or weekly about 4 years ago. And this year's the first year I said, I'm doing one every day. Like I'm not going to miss a day. Monday through Friday. I don't do them on the weekends, but I do one every day. And that consistency, you know, I can see it. I can see it happen in the engagement. I can see it happen to my followers. I can see it happen to people reaching out. I can see it on my web activity, people going to my website, people clicking on my links. Consistency is key.
That's awesome. What's the one question that I should have asked you, but I didn't? Or one topic that, or one thing that you wanted to add value to the audience?
Well, you know, at the end of life, what do you want to be remembered for? You know, what's that legacy you want to leave? So I think there's two things for me. Personally, I want, at the end of my life, I want people to look and say, that man loved Jesus and loved his wife. Like that, that's personal. You know, that's a personal thing. But from a professional standpoint, you know, I want people to know that I helped set 100,000 entrepreneurs free from the prison of entrepreneurship. And then I also helped 10,000 people escape poverty and mediocrity through entrepreneurship. And those are the two things professionally I'm working on every single day.
Yeah. You know, every time I think about, man, I should just go do something else, this producing content and this whole game of coaching, right? It's so hard. Then I'm like, man, I think this is my best chance to really reach people and change lives and really leave a legacy and an impact on other people. And that's what keeps me going when things aren't going so as well as my expectations are.
True. So
I love what you're doing. So how do people get a hold of you, follow you? You've got the podcast, you got the book. Just go to your site.
Yeah, go to therealjasonduncan.com. And I'm also at therealjasonduncan on the social media platforms, Instagram, LinkedIn, YouTube.
What's your podcast called?
It's called The Root of All Success.
How many episodes?
I think I've recorded 150. Nice. 150 episodes, yeah.
That's not easy to do. I just hit 128, or this will be like 130 or something. So
yeah, we're not too far apart.
Yeah, that's great. Well, congratulations on all your success and everything that you're doing, Jason. An incredible interview having you on the show. This is truly enlightening. I appreciate all your time.
It's been an honor, Jack. Thanks.
All right. Thanks, you guys. I will see you guys on the next episode.
That's a wrap for this episode on the Indestructible Wealth Podcast. If you'd like to dive deeper into your own wealth building strategy, check us out at myindestructiblewealth.com and follow along on LinkedIn, Facebook, Instagram, and yes, even TikTok. Send me your questions and your financial challenges, and I promise I'll respond. Also, I'll think you're really awesome if you'll share and leave me a 5-star rating and review on Apple Podcasts. Until next time, remember our mission here is to help you make, keep, and grow wealth you can enjoy now and for years to come.